And we return for today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Is there a biological or evolutionary basis for human foolishness? Paul Leary would know. How about a man who spends $30,000 a year on lotto tickets and is yet to win big? Many people splurge on luxury cars, yet some $2 million per year have them repossessed. Are we daft? Joining us now is Arizona State University professor Douglas Kenrick. He's the co-author of The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. And he joins us from station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Welcome to you, Doug Kenrick.
Great. Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So in spite of our at times seemingly irrational behavior, are we rational animals after all? I mean, do we have proof that we are?
Well, that's the controversy that we talk about in this book. There's a couple of different traditional views. You know, the classical view is the Wall Street view that in some sense we're all eminently rational. And in the book we talk about the poster child for that point of view is Joseph Patrick Kennedy, who was John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy's father. Mm-hmm. And he seemed like the eminently rational man. He made a series of very brilliant self-serving decisions throughout his life. He was a bank president by the time he was 25 years old, which was a record. And when the Boston Globe interviewed him and said, well, what do you want to do now? He said, well, I want to become a millionaire by the time I'm 30. Which in those days meant a lot more than it does today. The average income was around $1,000 a year. So Kennedy made good on that, and then he went into trading Wall Street stocks. He got out of the stock market just in time, just before the crash. Then he went on to found RKO Pictures, made a lot of money out in Hollywood. He had, in his personal life, he had a lot of other self-serving decisions. He was having an affair with the beautiful actress Gloria Swanson, who was working on a film in collaboration with RKO. And when her film went over budget, he dropped her and he left her holding the tab for the movie itself. So it was the classical Wall Street kind of what's in it for moi kind of guy. And he made out well. In the end of his life, he became the American ambassador to England, and he was plotting to have one of his sons become president of the United States.
Hmm. But his sons didn't make such rational decisions at times.
Right. That's a great point. So on the other side of the coin, along come a bunch of psychologists and what we call behavioral economists a couple of decades ago, and they started pointing out, hold on, people aren't that smart at all. In fact, you know, they do all kinds of dumb things. They forget their wife's birthday. They have a hangover on New Year's Day. If we were really rational, why would we do all these things that we later come to regret? And so behavioral economists start to accumulate lots of research which suggested that when we make decisions based upon not so much this ingenious supply of all the information we've processed in our lives, but just what's happened in the last minute or two. So we make quick snap decisions, and sometimes they're not very good decisions. We go with the last couple of things we heard, and we do things, for example, one of the classic examples, and this one won for Daniel Kahneman, who's now a psychology and economics professor at Princeton University. He won a Nobel Prize for his work in this area, and one of his findings was on something called loss aversion. To a rational economist, $100 is $100. It doesn't matter whether you've just found $100 or just lost $100. It's $100 plus or minus. But psychologically, what Kahneman found is that we respond very differently to $100 when we might lose it as compared to when we might gain it. In fact, we seem to place more value on the loss. We experience way more psychological movement from a loss of $100 than we do from a gain of a comparable $100. Again, seems irrational to an economist who just says $100 is $100, but people do all kinds of things to protect themselves from possible losses, even to the point of seeming neurotic at times. So If you go on to Wikipedia and look up cognitive biases, you'll see that cognitive psychologists and behavioral economists have accumulated a whole list of various kinds of biases and mistakes that humans make in their decisions. And I teach a social psychology class, and we love to kind of tease students with these things. Here's all the decision biases you have that cause you to make bad decisions. But it turns out that from an evolutionary perspective, a lot of people in the last decade or two are beginning to reconsider human thinking, the human brain, in light of what we know about other animal species, and asking the question of, well, if our brain evolved, it wouldn't really make sense for it to evolve to make a whole bunch of really dumb decisions. And so maybe these biases that we have aren't quite so dumb after all. Incidentally, back to your point, the poster children, you mentioned this, but the poster children for the behavioral economics viewpoint, which we talk about in our text, are Kennedy's kids. As you point out, the first one who was the handsome Joe Jr. was the one that Joe wanted to be president. Handsome, charming, he had it all going for him. He was a war hero. He had flown enough flights to go back to the United States during World War II, but instead he chose to volunteer for this extremely risky mission, flying a plane load full of bombs straight at the German lines. Well, it had what could have been a predictable outcome. He didn't make it. Then John Kennedy, he did get to be president, but he made some other kind of irrational decisions, you know, using the Secret Service to cover for him while he snuck women into the White House, which didn't stand so well with history. Bobby Kennedy watches his brother get killed. You think he would have dropped out and just lived on the family millions, but no, he goes out in public, he gets killed. Then their kids did even worse. I mean, Bobby's two kids, one was found in a Miami hotel room dead of a drug overdose. Another one died on a ski slope because he was playing football on the way down the hill. Not a very great idea, and resulted in his death. Then there was John's son, who was also handsome, charming. He was like the Joe Jr. of that generation. And he goes out at night flying from Long Island over to, I think it was Connecticut, and he ends up crashing his plane into the Long Island Sound, is never heard from again. So it seems like that generation of Kennedys looks like, wow, people are irrational. They're not rational at all. But it turns out, so I went on Wikipedia and I looked at Joseph Patrick Kennedy and Rose Fitzgerald's descendants. You can find a family tree there. And there are at least 60 grandchildren and then even more great-grandchildren. So from the gene's eye perspective, if you ask the question of how did Joe Kennedy's genes actually make out over the long haul, yes, his descendants made a lot of risky decisions, as he did, but on average, they did okay. They survived, they made a lot of money, they made a lot of connections. In fact, his descendants now are well-connected, popular people. Some of them are politicians, some of them are financiers, some of them are philanthropists. And again, from the evolutionary perspective, human beings, like all other animals, would be designed not to avoid all risks, but to sort of carefully choose between their risks.
How about what's behind, say, a Tiger Woods or Elliot Spitzer making such dumb decisions? Tiger Woods, he's on top of the world making millions.
Right.
He's got this beautiful Swedish wife, and he's messing around with waitresses.
Right, exactly. So we actually have a whole chapter on that called kind of the his and hers versions of rationality. And there's a whole abundant amount of research on reproductive strategies in men and women and how they compare with reproductive strategies in other animals. One of the things that we inherited from our ancestors is a bit of a sex difference in what are going to be the payoffs for having multiple mates. For a female mammal, any female mammal, let's take a horse or a cow, it doesn't necessarily do her any good to have 100 different mates. Her genes aren't going to survive any better if she's got 100 mates. All she needs is one, okay, because the typical mammalian male contributes, you know, his genes to the offspring. And in most other species, other than humans, he then goes on his way. It's sort of like a one-night stand in Los Angeles in 1973. for 95% of mammals have that one-night stand kind of mating strategy. Humans are a little bit different, but we still have this mammalian difference such that the females carry the babies inside their bodies. The females then nurse the babies once they're born. And in all human societies, even in modern Sweden, where the husbands often will stay home and take care of the kids, the women still end up spending more time with the children. And there's a sort of a biological reason for that. The women are designed to produce babies and to nurse them, at least. But human males, I mean, we're better than the typical mammalian male. We hang around at least for a few years and often for a lifetime. But there's still this difference that if a female had 100 husbands, which never happens, in Tibet, in some very poor areas, a woman might marry a group of brothers. And that's probably because, it's for the same reason in the animal kingdom, sometimes a female gets attached to several different brothers. The benefits for the female in that case and for the brothers are that there's very scarce resources and children with only two parents or offspring with two parents don't survive. So the other side of that coin, though, is sort of down the hill from Tibet. You have people like Rajinder Singh, who was the sixth Maharaja of the state of Patiala, who had 350 wives. No woman would ever want 350 husbands. Why would a man have... maybe one is too many sometimes. That's what my wife tells me, but in any event, why would Rajendra Singh want 350 wives? Well, it turns out that in some sense he's playing a typical mammalian strategy. If a male has sufficient resources or territory in other species, multiple females may choose him. And in India, Rajendra Singh was immensely wealthy. Poor people in his area would sometimes die of starvation. So for a woman marrying one man, there's the benefit of having all that guy's attention. But if he's poor, he might not be able to feed the children. If she attaches herself to Rajinder Singh, well, she doesn't get much attention from him individually, but he has all that wealth. And so the wealthy man's children are much less likely to die during periods of starvation. So women will essentially attach themselves in polygynous arrangements when one family has immense amounts of wealth. It's actually sort of the same thing in the animal kingdom. It's when one, for example, when one indigo bunting can control a very nice territory, he may get multiple females instead of just one female because basically the females are attracted to the food and not necessarily to the male himself. They're attracted to what he can provide for their offspring. So that answers the question of why would these women be interested in Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods, in a sense, was playing a typical mammalian strategy in the sense of he had immense amounts of power, wealth, and attractiveness, and lots of women offered themselves to him. And unfortunately, from a moral perspective, men aren't all that great. There was actually a study that was done at Florida State many years ago. And it involved a student, a young undergraduate female walking up to a guy on campus, or a young undergraduate male walking up to a woman with one of three lines. It's a famous study, you may have heard of it. It said, "Excuse me, I've seen you around campus and I find you attractive." And then they asked either, "Would you like to go on a date?" Or, "Would you like to go to my room?" Or, "Would you like to go to bed with me?"
Well, can we take a short break and let everyone be in suspense until we come back and find out the answer to that? We are speaking with Douglas Kendrick. He's an author and professor of psychology at Arizona State University. He co-authored his latest book with, I'll try this now, Vladis Griskevicius.
I knew you were going to blow
it. You got it. No, that was good.
No, that was good. Okay. And he's a marketing and psychology professor at University of Minnesota. The name of the book is The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. And we're going to come back and get the mystery solved on Topical Currents. Stay with us. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Douglas Kendrick. His latest book that he co-authored is The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. So
I've never been propositioned like that.
Well, we're going to go back to that study. It was at the University of Florida, was it?
Florida State.
It was at Florida State.
Florida State. Okay, so tell us now, continue.
Okay, so again, stranger walks up to you and invites you to either go on a date or to go to their room or go to bed with them, how would you respond? Well, on the one hand, when it was, you know, I've seen you around, I find you attractive, would like to go on a date, 50% of both the men and the women said yes to that. So these people must have been kind of, you know, reasonably charming and pleasant.
Mm-hmm. And, well, you might ask, what's it going to cost?
Right. They didn't ask that. They just sort of said, yeah, you know. So, but it depends upon, right, which sex may ask a different question. But when it comes to cost, so now things change when it comes to, would you go to my room with me? There, 60% of the men said yes. So it goes up a little bit. They're happier to go to the room than on a date, which is maybe because it's less expensive. But then how many women said yes? About 4 or 5% of women said yes to that.
Just 4 or 5%?
4 or 5%.
Okay.
But would you go to bed with me? You guys want to guess what how the men and women broke out on that one?
I'd say the women said no about maybe 100%, and the men said about 100% said yes.
Okay, well, there was a small percentage of men that held out. Okay, you're right about the women. All the women said no, and they said things like, get away from me, what are you crazy? whereas the men, it was 73% of the men said yes. So there was about, you know, a quarter of the men said no. But even those men, instead of saying, get away from me, you're crazy, they said, oh, I'm sorry. But, you know, I just got engaged or my girlfriend's in town. It really wouldn't be right. So they actually apologized if they said no.
Oh, okay.
The men. So in any event, that's a gigantic difference. It's kind of controversial because some people say, oh, gee, what if the guy looked like a movie star? Well, if he was a movie star, if he was Tiger Woods, he might get a different response. But for an average guy, like one of you just mentioned this, you've never had a proposition like this. the average guy doesn't have strangers walking up to him on the street and asking him, would he like to go to bed with them? But if he did, it's sad to say, depending on your perspective, that he probably, there's a 3 out of 4 chances that he would say, sure, why not? And sometimes the woman actually said, would you like to go to bed with me tonight? And some of the guys said, do we have to wait until tonight?
Oh, my.
And so basically Tiger Woods was in this position where he was always being offered opportunities by very attractive women, unlike the average guy on the street. And he wasn't very good at resisting them.
But what about this loss aversion? How does that enter into it? Because wouldn't he think, I have a lot to lose by doing this? Tiger Woods, my reputation, my status, my wife, not to mention my wife. I think he had a child.
Yes, right.
So, yeah.
So, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, let's return to loss aversion again in a minute. But in some sense, the loss, it's people at a higher level than Tiger Woods who have gotten involved in things like this. One of the last presidents, Bill Clinton, mm-hmm. kept getting himself into trouble with these kinds of decisions. And why would he do that? Because if he gets discovered, he would, you know, as he did, he was, brought before
impeached.
Congress for impeachment for that. And why do guys do that? Well, from an evolutionary perspective, an evolutionary biologist would simply say that the name of the game is reproduction. Okay, and that all of the reason that men struggle so hard for status and wealth and resources is ultimately to gain a reproductive advantage over other men. And so from that perspective, from the perspective of the man's genes, it's a rational decision. From a moral perspective, from the perspective of what we would like to see happening in a theoretically monogamous society, it's not something we desire. It's an interesting question. I believe Bill Clinton when he said he felt guilty about these things. He felt bad. Martin Luther King, another person who we hold up as a kind of a pinnacle of morality, made decisions, sacrificed his own life in some sense for civil rights, nevertheless was extremely bad at turning down opportunities for sexual relationships. And one argument would be that it's easier for women to say no than for men to say no, because for a woman, there's just not as much of an advantage in it. For a man, he's got all that mammalian genetic yeah, predisposition. Again, not that men can't. Lots of men do say no. Lots of famous men have no affairs, and it's possible. But there's probably always an internal moral struggle.
From an evolutionary standpoint, is it really not natural for humans to be monogamous?
But that's an interesting.
If you go back eons
and
eons, back to hunter gatherers, and
it's a controversial question. Probably what most biologists would tell you today is that humans play a kind of a two-part strategy. One strategy is the standard mammalian strategy, in which females choose the most dominant, attractive, the guys with the good genes, that the biologists would say. And under those circumstances, like most other mammals, we would say that we have the possibility of mating like other mammals. On the other hand, there's something different about human beings, and that is something we actually share in common with a lot more birds than with other mammals, and that is that our offspring are very helpless. So birds lay these big, gigantic eggs. The eggs are a target for predators, and so having two parents is a good thing. So what you find is that in many bird species, they are mostly monogamous. They're finding now in more careful examination that they're a little bit like humans in that they slip once in a while, okay? But they're mostly, a lot of bird species are monogamous. Why would that evolve? Well, that would evolve when having a male around to provide resources increases the probability of the offspring's survival. And we're clearly one of those species. We're a species in which it's good to have a male around. Now, if the male has a lot of resources, then it's a sort of a, from the economic biological perspective, it might make sense for multiple females to choose him, as they did for Tiger Woods and Bill Clinton and Rajinder Singh, the sixth Maharaja of the state of Patiala,
or Brigham Young.
Yes, and in fact, many of these. An interesting thing happens with these. I give a lecture on cults in my social psychology class, and one of the things that's fascinating is that when these guys start to get a lot of power, and they start to have, you know, these very persuasive, charming guys, they get a lot of power and lots of people sort of looking up to them, they almost always change the rules so that, oh, by the way, I'm God's vicar on earth, I get to have multiple mates. The guy in Texas, Waco, Texas guy?
Oh, yes.
David Koresh.
Yeah.
And then the Jim Jones guy out in California. And you see it in cults all the time. Even these cults where asceticism is the norm, where you're supposed to deprive yourself. Yeah, it's always happening. When the guy gets a lot of power and his testosterone goes up, he seems to just change the rules so that now it's okay for him. And Brigham Young was doing the same thing. In fact, Brigham Young didn't tell his wife about his new rule for quite a while, because he knew that she would give him a hard time about it. As happens now, and there are still some Mormon societies in southern Utah and northern Arizona, and there's always a fight between the existing wives and the husband about taking on a new wife. Why? Because it's now going to be a division of the resources.
If we'd like to invite our audience to join in the conversation, we're speaking with Douglas Kenrick, and he's co-authored The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. To join with a question or comment, it's 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@WLRN.org. Should we take a break now?
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, stay with us. We're going to take that break. You can make your calls or your emails, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Douglas Kenrick, who has written The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. Very interesting, Joe. We gave the number out and the phones have lit up. I wonder what you have coming, Professor. Yes. I wanted to get to the very interesting thing of the sub-cells inside our brains.
Yes.
So, because I think it's important to all of this. So we have these subdivisions, you say little executive systems that are in charge of different things. So are we all actually multiple personalities? Is that what it amounts to? We all have multiple personalities?
Right. That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. Because One of the other points we talked about in this book is a lot of evidence from sort of neuroscience and from evolutionary biology has begun to converge on this idea that the brain itself, rather than being just this one big unprogrammed computer, has a bunch of subdivisions, the sub-programs that deal with different kinds of problems. And in the land of the social world, which is what a lot of what we spend a lot of time thinking about, our relationships with other people, we argue that there's seven different kinds of big problems we need to solve, and they're solving one is requires different rules than solving another. So for example, how do you take care of your children as compared to how do you deal with your friends, as compared to how do you make a business deal between strangers? The classical Wall Street model is all based on deals between strangers. I try to get as much out of you as I can and give as little as I can. But we don't deal with our friends like that. In fact, with our friends, we take turns, we make sure everyone gets an equal share. And with our children, it doesn't work that way at all. In fact, I like to joke with my son about the fact that he decided to go, instead of going to Arizona State University for free on a scholarship, he decided to go to New York University to study film. Cost me a lot more money. And I think he once said, thanks, but I don't expect to get the money back from him as I would if I had invested in something else, okay?
Right.
And in fact, I'm happy to provide my resources to I have two sons, one is 9 and one's 35, and I'm happy to give them money.
It's quite an age span.
It's too loud. That is a big age span, yes, right.
Douglas Kenrick, discuss the choices made by perhaps history's biggest swindler, Bernie Madoff. He knew he was going to get caught. What's behind that from an evolutionary standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, that's one that I'm not sure I have a great answer for that. I do have a little bit to say about the game that he played, because we have a chapter in the book called Deep Rationality Parasites. So our argument is that there's different kinds of rationality associated with these different subcells, and they can be exploited in different ways. And Bernie Madoff was able to exploit maybe one or two of these different. So one of the subcells we have is the kind of the tribal subcell where we group together to protect ourselves against outgroup members. And so Bernie Madoff was a member of the Jewish community in New York, where there's a lot of kind of close identity because, you know, basically a lot of people who are descendants of folks that were killed or their relatives were killed in concentration camps. So there's a sense of bonding together with the tribe to stick together and help ourselves out. And Madoff took advantage of that by basically appealing to other very wealthy members of Jewish families with kind of the in-group thing. You know, he, in fact, went out of his way to market his product, which had nothing behind it, to fellow sort of wealthy Jewish people. And he apparently bilked people out of billions of dollars. And he was kind of using, he was using a trick that animals often use on one another. They pretend to be something that they're really not. They pretend there's a particular.
He would actually shun investors and make them go even farther.
Ah, no kidding. So he used a lot of tricks. Bernie Madoff did. And in fact, there's a lot of that out there. If we have a mechanism that says, "Okay, I want to take care of my family," then there's going to be somebody out there. The advertisers are going to try to take advantage of that. They're going to be, when people try to sell fire insurance, the first thing they want to talk to you about is your children. Because they want you to think, oh ho, there's no expense that I would spare for my children, and so go ahead, where do I sign?
With Madoff, though, there was sort of a Tom Sawyer and the whitewashed fence thing. Oh no, you can't do a good job.
Yes, right, yeah. That's another trick that he used. Both Vlad Griskevicius and I were students of Bob Cialdini, who has a book called Influence, which is a very best-selling book. It lists a whole bunch of different tricks that compliance professionals use in order to get people to, you know, our basic inclination is to not want to part with our money, and compliance professionals are very good at kind of getting inside and tricking us. The metaphor that Cialdini uses there's a fish it's a parasitic little fish, and it looks like a cleaner goby. So there's a fish that comes along and will clean off the scales and the parasites off of sharks and moray eels, and those big fish tolerate it. Then there's another fish that looks just like it. It swims up, it has the same shiny line, the same pattern of movement, swims right up, and then yanks a chunk of flesh out. And Cialdini makes the argument that that's a lot of people out there who are trying to trick you out of your money are like that. They're pretending to be like the cleaner fish, but they're really going to take a chunk out of your flesh.
Let's take a let's take a call or two, Professor. This is listener Mike. He's in Miami. Hi.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon to all of you.
Hello.
Hi. I have a question. If you say this is evolutionary or human nature, a woman sees man get power and resources and she's attracted to him. Man gets power and resources and he now goes out seeking, or he has the power and the opportunity to attract these females. Why, when it happens and someone gets caught, you make such a big brouhaha about it? Isn't it, as you say, it's natural, it's human nature? Why was Tiger Woods condemned so severely for doing something that happens throughout history?
Right, that's a lovely question. I like that question. One of the things is that human beings live in societies. We live with other members, other people whose self-interests don't coincide with ours. And in fact, throughout the natural world, there's a conflict of interest. What's in it? It's in the lion's interests to eat me for lunch. It's in my interest not to be eaten. Okay, so it may be in Tiger Woods' interest to have as many mates as he can, but for other guys, it's in their interest to make sure that guys who are in these positions of power get watched so that they don't take too great of an advantage, because the more mates that Tiger Woods has, the fewer there are for the rest of us. And so Robert Kurzban and some of his colleagues do some interesting stuff on the evolutionary psychology of morality. And one of the things that they argue is that we have moral rules because not so much to keep ourselves in check, but to keep other people in check. We develop moral rules to say, hey, you can't do that. Why? Because you're basically going to be subtracting from, my pool of resources. Mm.
Can we overrule these subcells, or is it a done deal? I mean, can we intervene in their activation, the ones that govern our decision making, or are we absolutely helpless in the face of them?
No, that's a great question. I mean, I would say that we are not helpless in the face of them. I mean, we can do things that, I went to Catholic school as a child, and one of the things they teach you is lots of little techniques for avoiding temptation, for changing, changing the way you're thinking, for not going into a place that might cause you to be tempted in some way. And that's, the reason that the churches do those kinds of things is because there's some effectiveness to that. We can't avoid temptation. We can keep ourselves. One of the things that we recommend is that people keep a sort of little mental Rolodex in their head of the different people who represent their different subselves. So we have one for parenting, one for mating. The one for mating is the one that gets guys in trouble a lot of the time. But if Martin Luther King or Tiger Woods or Bill Clinton were to sort of roll to the picture of their daughter when they were tempted, then they might make a different decision. In fact, we have research that suggests that people's decisions go in very different ways depending upon which one of your subselves is currently activated. Hmm.
So if you don't want to get a haircut, don't go to the barber shop.
Right. Yeah. Or if you don't want to if you don't want to overeat,
there's some other scenarios though we could go to.
Professor,
don't
we
go
have
hang
just
around in the bakery.
A couple of things about that survey you said. So Evan says, when was it done, the survey? He says, my friend's daughter goes to a large Florida university and finds that girls have become much more aggressive. And then someone else without a name says he doesn't believe the poll that so few women said they would not go to bed on request.
Right. Well, they did it twice. So I think they did it. But it's a good question of when did they do it. They did it once in the late 70s and once in the late 80s and found the exact same results both times. But I just saw a study that was done in Denmark, I believe it was. And there they found maybe one woman in the group who said yes. So depending upon when you do it, and the men weren't actually also. Not all the men were willing to jump into bed with the women. In this study done in the modern, in like 2 or 3 years ago in Denmark. So depending upon where you are, These things are going to change a lot. Now, they don't. When they change, that doesn't mean that there's no biology involved. One of the things that causes people to play different games is things like the sex ratio. When there's a lot of women and very few men, women tend to be more relatively promiscuous. When there's a lot of men and very few women, men tend to be much more monogamous. They want to make sure they don't lose their partner. Because most guys are not in the Tiger Woods
like
position.
Like in Alaska or something.
In Alaska. You might expect, I don't know on this, but you might expect men in Alaska that if they get a woman, they're going to hang on to her. And they're not going to do anything to mess that up.
Loss averse. They won't.
Men.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. They should become loss averse.
Right.
Let's take another caller. We've got Carlos. He's in Miami Beach. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about how right now, you know, we're evolving and we're talking about evolution. I wanted to hear your take on what you think might happen in the future as far as relationships, monogamy, marriage as an institution, that sort of thing, you know, like a look into the future. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Okay. It's a great question.
Yeah.
Of course, we can't really predict the future. We can say, given what we know now, it would be a long time before humans, for example, stopped being morally outraged by other people's sexual behavior. I assume that some species like chimpanzees or bonobos don't get outraged at one another's sexual behavior, but human beings do. I think it's going to be quite a while. Why? Because we're basically, one of the things that animals do, and humans in particular do this, is that we create societies sort of in our own image. We've constructed societies that have a whole set of rules that are designed to facilitate our mating strategies. So our religious groups encourage monogamy. They give a little extra boost to those guys like Tiger Woods and Bill Clinton.
Well,
to
most
say,
polls
hey,
show a decline in religiosity. How will that affect...
Right. So decline in religiosity you would expect to be associated with. My colleague Jason Whedon has done some interesting research that suggests that, you know, the conflict between sort of the right wing that supported Bush versus the kind of liberal left wing that supports Obama. One of the big differences there is, in fact, related to mating strategies, that the people, the kind of Southern fundamentalist Christians, are in a position where they really don't want a promiscuous society. They like to have a lot of strong rules to keep the families together because people there tend not to, let's look at the other side. People that go to graduate school, like get a degree in law or a PhD or something, they're in school for a long time. They don't want a bunch of rules that say we can't have sex until we get married because they're not planning on getting married until they're 28 or 30 years old. And so the highly educated people tend to be very liberal. And what you might be expecting is that there's going to be this dynamic change in terms of if people become more educated, they're actually not going to want as many stringent rules on their sexual behavior. And in Europe now, for example, I was just traveling in France. And from what I hear, France, which I thought of as a Catholic country, people are much less religious in modern France. They're also much more educated. So in some sense, the concern, a lot of people that are very conservative or kind of anti-education, and they may sort of have reason to be not the one that's in the mind that, well, you know, these people are all kind of creating trouble. It's just that as people become more educated, they delay their marriage. As they delay their marriage, they don't want a lot of stringent rules and fierce, you know, enforcement of monogamy and premarital sex rules because they're not going to be able to hold out. So there is, you know, again, there's a dynamic interaction between the cultures we create, the rules we create with those cultures, and our basic human nature. And so,
how did this discussion focus on sex, Professor?
Yes, I don't know, because the book's about economics.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of economics.
We need to take another break. We're going to maybe get to some more economics instead. Douglas Kenrick, the author of The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think, professor of psychology at Arizona State. Let's take another break, and we'll return.
Yeah, And a snappy return. It's today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Arizona State University professor Douglas Kenrick. He's joining us from Tempe, Arizona. And let's take another call. We've got Rosanna in Miami. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm just wondering, for the first talk about Tiger Woods or Bill Clinton with the multiple partners, why that doesn't apply to females as well? I mean, females could have or tend to have affairs with, when they meet a guy that probably has better genes than their chosen partner. And I think that's something that happened too, actually, not only changing partners, but also could have multiple affairs with, you know, multiple people that they find that may have better genes and still get married because they have the security of a good provider at home. Thank you.
Okay. Right, that's a good point. There's actually Marty Hazelton out at UCLA. She does some research on what's called the dual mating strategy in females, which this question actually touches right on. There is some evidence that suggests that women often play a different strategy, and it can fluctuate depending upon ovulatory cycle. When women are ovulating, they suddenly become interested in these sort of handsome, dominant guys, the George Clooney types, or the, you know, whoever the latest handsome, you know, muscular actor is. And what the argument is that Marty Hazelton and her colleagues make is that exactly as the listener just pointed out, that women may sometimes be playing a game in which they're getting genes from one guy and resources from another guy. And so it's certainly not the case that women are by design exclusively monogamous. Again, different women are playing different strategies. It kind of depends upon who is the woman, who is her partner, what's her current economic circumstances, what's the sex ratio, all of those things that tend to play into this. But the argument is not that men are promiscuous. Men are sometimes promiscuous, sometimes monogamous, depending upon the biologically relevant context, nor that women are always monogamous. Women are sometimes not monogamous, depending upon the context. I want to get back to the question that you raised just before the break, though, which is that, well, how do we get back to sex? And go back to sort of connect, to bridge the kind of economics and sex with the subself stuff, if you could permit me to describe.
Certainly.
One thing quickly.
Okay, sure.
We did some research looking at how people make economic decisions as a function of whether or not their sort of mating subself is activated, or their self-protection subself, the one that's the frightened one, that when you're walking around at night and it's kind of scary and there's some, you know, bad-looking, tough-looking guys walking down the other side of the street. And one of the things that we found, we returned to this phenomenon of loss aversion, which, as I pointed out to you before, people feel more movement psychologically at losing $100 than at gaining $100. And one of the things that we found is that when people are feeling, when their self-protective sub-self is activated, they are more loss averse than usual. They really are worried about losing that resource, whether it's $100 or whatever else. On the other hand, when they're in a mating frame of mind, now you find that men and women do different things. The economics changes for men and women. Women remain quite careful and loss averse when mating is on the horizon. Why? Because it's always, whether you're choosing Tiger Woods or whichever guy you're choosing, it's always a costly decision for a woman because she might get pregnant and have to bear the offspring. For a man, on the other hand, when he's in a mating frame of mind, from an evolutionary perspective, he needs to play the peacock. And in fact, consistent with that, we find that men, suddenly loss aversion goes away and men stop worrying about losing money, and they become more concerned with gaining money when they're in a mating frame of mind. So again, the economics seems to change for men and women in a mating frame of mind, but the economics is the same for men and women when it comes to protecting themselves, probably when it comes to taking care of their kids, and probably when it comes to dealing with their friends and so forth.
Richard wants to know, through evolution, haven't we obtained higher order cognitive functions, such as executive function, that should be capable of overriding base motivations, such as reproductive needs?
Right. So that's a very interesting question. Is there a separate executive function that has nothing to do with any of these subcells. And what we would argue is that no, there's actually each of the subcells has a different executive decision maker, and there's always a controversy going on in your head as which one's going to win. Okay, and it kind of depends upon where are you now, what are the available opportunities, and what are the potential costs of making those decisions, which one of your subcells is in the driving seat. But they all have executive. Each of the subcells has an executive function, and it can override the others. So there is going to be a conflict. But I would say it's a mistake to think that somehow there's another executive subcell that has nothing to do with motives, that doesn't care about reproduction, that doesn't care about friendship, that simply makes economic decisions.
So we're all just naked apes.
Well, we're all multiple, we're all divided personalities, and inside of our heads we have, you know, several different people, some of whom are, you know, very, very civilized.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but when the subcells are in conflict with each other, as can happen when one just doesn't override another, what happens when they're actually in conflict? I mean, is that when we're just undecided or...
Right, that's why I think you're going to find yourself walking kind of back and forth. What should I do? What should
right.
I do? When in fact, either decision, if you let your mating subself or your fear of subself win, is going to be costly to you. Although I think in the end, one of them has to win. Usually we do tend to, we somehow, despite the fact that there are multiple executive systems inside our head, most of us somehow manage to put one foot in front of the other and move on and make decisions.
Well, it's Indeed. Been a very interesting hour. We've been speaking with Douglas Kenrick. He's a professor of psychology at Arizona State University and co-authored his latest book with Vladas, give me a moment here, Griskevicius, who is a professor of marketing psychology at the University of Minnesota. The name of the book is The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. Thank you so much, Professor, for joining
thank
us
you.
Today.
It's great talking to you.
Thank you. And thank you for tuning in. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program, sort of along the same vein, it's with two psychologists who've collaborated on the book Emotionally Focused Couples Therapy for Dummies. Also, Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining focuses on gourmet holiday fare. Caviar. Smoked salmon. Chocolate. And today's calendar, on this day in 1943, 70 years ago, the birth of Rolling Stone guitarist and composer Keith Richards in Dartmouth, Kent, England. He and Mick Jagger went to the same elementary school. A critic said Richard was mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And on this day in 1963, 50 years ago, the birth of actor Brad Pitt in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Raised as a Southern Baptist, his step to stardom began as the seducer in Thelma and Louise. One more before we dance. On this day in 1980, 33 years ago, the birth of Christina Aguilera on Staten Island. She grew up in Pittsburgh, of Hispanic and Irish descent. She's said to have a four-octave voice. Her biggest influence is the great Etta James. At Last, Damn Your Eyes. So we leave with a thought from Keith Richards, whose great influence was Chuck Berry. Quote, I remember a sense of doom when our first record got in the top 20. It was conventional wisdom at the time that it would all be over in 2 years. 50 years ago. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned now for Here and Now from NPR News.